28. They had been underway for 6 hours. The guidance system had failed 2 or 3 times an hour initially, but lately the ride had become lullingly smooth, with only the occasional stomach-churning veer or swerve. They had eaten a light snack of pre-packed rations. The food was tucked into unmarked foil pouches that, to Floyd's obvious delight and fascination, warmed the food automatically when they were opened. And Floyd had explored the tiny intimate microcosm of the toilet, with its daunting methods of collecting bodily waste under weightless conditions. Auger had asked him if he felt any motion sickness, and he had replied truthfully that he felt none. "Good," she said, popping a dark pill into her mouth. "It must be all that time you spent at sea. Good practice for a trip down a wormhole, even though you probably didn't realize it at the time." "Are you feeling ill?" he asked. "Apart from the fact that I've got a bullet lodged in my body that the robot thinks might kill me, no, I've never felt better." "I meant the pill." "It's you are," she answered as if that explained everything. When Floyd just stared at her, she said, "Universal restorative, general purpose medicine. It will heal anything, cure any ill. It'll even keep you alive forever."
"Then you're immortal?" he said.
"No, of course not," Auger said, as if the very idea embarrassed her. "If I took one of these every day, or every week, or however often it is you have to take them, then I might be, I suppose. At least until the supply ran out, or I got some disease so fascinatingly exotic that even the UR couldn't fix it. But there isn't enough UR in the whole system for me to take it all the time. And in any case, my people don't agree with it." "You don't agree with medicine that makes you immortal?" he asked, a little surprised by her statement.
"There's more to it than that. My side, the Usni, the Threshers, call us what you will, doesn't have the means to make you are. What you are we do have access to is supplied in very small, expensive, and controlled quantities by our moderate allies in the polities."
"Haven't you tried making it yourselves?" She popped another pill from the cylindrical dispenser and held it up for Floyd's inspection. It looked no more impressive than a discarded button or a nub of dark clay. "We couldn't make it even if we knew the recipe. The technology embedded in this pill is one that we've chosen to reject." With particular care, she returned the pill to its canister, except, of course, when we really need it, which tends to be on high-risk operations like this. So call us screaming hypocrites and see if we care.
"What's so dangerous about a technology used to make pills?"
"The technology is a lot broader in its applications," Auger said. "This isn't really a pill. It's a solid mass composed of billions of tiny machines, smaller than the eye can see. You wouldn't even see them under a microscope. But they're real, and they're the most dangerous thing in the world."
"And yet they can heal you."
"They swim into your body after you've swallowed the pill. They're smart enough to identify what's wrong with you, and adept enough to put it right. The bodies of the Slashers are already swarming with tiny, immortal machines. They don't even need UR, since nothing ever goes wrong with them."
"Can't you be like that?"
"We could if we wanted to. But a long time ago, something bad happened that convinced us that the Slashers were wrong, or at least foolhardy, to embrace that technology so wholeheartedly. It wasn't just..." And then she said something that sounded worryingly close to banana technology, but which Floyd assumed, hoped, for the sake of his sanity, he'd misheard. "Not just that," she continued, "but virtual reality, radical genetic engineering, neural reshaping, and the digital manipulation of data. We rejected all that. We even established a high-level quasi-governmental organization, the Threshold Committee, to keep us back from the brink of ever developing any of those lethal toys by accident. We wanted to stay on the cusp, the threshold, but never quite cross it. The Slashers call us Threshers. It's intended as an insult, but we're quite happy to apply it to ourselves."
"The bad thing that happened," Floyd said. "What was it?"
"We destroyed the Earth," Auger said.
"That'll do it."
"The thing is, Floyd, it didn't have to happen the way it did. If we allowed your world to run forward in time from the present, maybe we'd never end up with what happened in 2077, and everything would be different now. Not necessarily better, but different."
"I'm not following you."
"You and I don't share the same history, Floyd. After 1940, there's nothing in common between our two worlds."
"What's the significance of 1940?
"That's the year when Germany attempted to invade France. In your timeline, the invading forces ground to a halt in the Ardennes, becoming sitting ducks waiting for the Allied planes to bomb them into the mud. The war was over by the end of the year."
And in your timeline? The invasion was a staggering success. By the end of 1940, there were very few places in Europe and North Africa that the German army hadn't occupied. By the end of 1941, the Japanese had joined forces with the Nazis. They launched a surprise attack on America, turning the whole thing into a global conflict. It was mechanized warfare on a scale the world had never seen before. It's what we call the Second World War. You don't say. It lasted until 1945. The Allies won, but the cost was considerable. By the time the war was over, the world was a completely different place. We'd let too many genies out of too many bottles. Such as? I don't even know where to begin, Auger said. The Germans developed high-altitude rockets to bomb London. Within a couple of decades, the same technology would put people on the moon. The Americans developed atomic bombs that were used to flatten Japanese cities in a single strike. Within a couple of decades, those bombs had become powerful enough to wipe out humanity many times over, in less time than it takes you to make breakfast. Then there were the computers. You've seen the Enigma machines? They played a significant role in wartime cryptography, but the Allies built bigger, faster machines to crack the Enigma messages. Those machines filled entire rooms and drank enough power to light up an office block, but they became smaller and faster. Much smaller and much faster. They shrank down to the point where you could barely see them. Valves became transistors. Transistors became integrated circuits. Integrated circuits became microprocessors. And microprocessors became quantum optic processors. And still it snowballed. Within a few decades, there was no aspect of living that hadn't been touched by computers. They were everywhere, so ubiquitous that you almost didn't notice them anymore. They were in our homes, in our animals, in our money, even in our bodies. And even that was just the beginning. Because by the beginning of the new century, some people were not content with just having very small machines that could process a lot of data very quickly. They wanted very small machines that could process matter itself, move it around, organize and reorganize it on a microscopic scale.
Why do I have the impression that this wasn't necessarily a good thing? Floyd asked.
Because it wasn't. Oh, the idea was sound. And the tiny machines did a lot of good in many areas of human life. UR was on the good side of the equation. The trouble is, when you're dealing with what is, in essence, a new form of life, there simply isn't room to make too many mistakes.
And human nature being what it is, Floyd said.
It was late July 2077, Auger said. For the last couple of years, we'd been busy releasing tiny machines into the environment in an attempt to fix the climate. The planet had been heating up for more than a century as we spewed crap into the atmosphere. The oceans were screwed up. Sea levels were rising, flooding coastal towns and cities. There were freak storms. Some places got colder. Some places got hotter. Some places just got strange, really strange. And that was when some coalition of dickheads had the idea that we ought to try squirting some intelligence into the weather system. Smart weather, they called it.
Smart weather, Floyd echoed, shaking his head incredulously.
Big dumb idea would have been closer to the truth. It was going to solve all our problems, whether we could turn on and off, whether we could boss around. We seeded the oceans and the upper atmosphere with tiny floating machines, invisible to the eye, harmless to people, unthinkable numbers of them, self-replicating, self-redesigning, self-coordinating. They reflected radiation here, absorbed it there, cooled down this place, warmed up that place, made clouds bloom and disperse in geometric patterns, like something from a Dalí painting. Made deep ocean currents bend through right angles and flow through each other, like rush hour traffic. They even made money out of it, painting 1,000-kilometer-wide corporate logos across the Pacific Ocean in phytoplankton. They could arrange a local enhancement in the colours of the sunset, as viewed from your private island. A little more green tonight, sir? No problem at all. And you know, for a while, it actually worked. The climate stabilised and began to creep back to pre-2050 conditions. The ice caps began to grow again. The deserts began to retreat. The hot spots began to cool down. People began to move back to cities they'd abandoned 20 years earlier. Call me a fatalist, Floyd said. But I sense a but coming along. It was never going to work. Late in 2076, there were rumours, unconfirmed reports of some weather patterns refusing to follow orders, ocean circulation events no one could turn off, clouds that wouldn't disperse no matter what you did to them, a persistent obscene symbol off the Bay of Biscay that had to be airbrushed out of every satellite image. It was clear, even though no one was admitting it, that some of the machines had evolved a little too far. They were more interested in their own self-preservation than obeying sequenced shutdown and disassemble commands. So you know what the coalition of dickheads did for an encore? I'm sure you're about to tell me. They came up with some even cleverer, slyer machines and said they'd sort out the first wave. And so they were given authorization to inject these into the environment as well. Trouble is, they only made things worse. Teething problems, they said. Meanwhile, the out-of-control weather events were getting more freakish by the hour, far worse than anything we'd had to deal with before. Now it was mechanized weather. By mid-2077, they'd thrown 8 layers of technology into the fray and things hadn't improved. But then there was a hopeful sign. In early July of that year, the obscene symbol dissipated. Everyone got very excited, saying that the tide was turning and the machines had begun to return to human control. They all breathed one vast collective sigh of relief, which I take it was premature. The phytoplankton bloom, making up the obscene symbol, had vanished for a reason. The machines had eaten the plankton. They'd started using living organisms to fuel themselves. It was against the most fundamental structures built into their programming. They weren't supposed to harm living things, but still they did it. And it got much worse, really fast. After the plankton, they worked their way up the marine food chain pretty damn quickly. By mid-July, there wasn't much left alive in the entire Atlantic Ocean, apart from the machines. By the 20th of that month, the machines had begun to attack land-based organisms. For a few days, the whiz kids still thought they could keep a lid on things. They had some small successes, but not enough to make a difference. On the 27th, the machines digested humanity. It happened very quickly. So quickly, it was almost funny. It was like the Black Death directed by Buster Keaton. By the 28th, with the exception of a few extremophile organisms buried deep underground, there were no living things left alive on Earth. But someone must have survived, Floyd said, or else you wouldn't be here to tell me any of this. Some people made it through, Auger said. They were the ones who'd already left the surface of the Earth, moving into space habitats and colonies. Primitive ramshackle affairs, barely self-sufficient, but enough to keep them alive while they coped with the loss of the Earth and the numbing psychic trauma of what had happened. It was about then that we split into two political groupings. My people, the Threshers, said that nothing like this could ever be allowed to happen again, which is why we rejected the nanotechnology that had led to the development of the machines, and so much more, in the first place. The Slashers, on the other hand, thought that the damage was done, and that there was no point in limiting themselves out of some misguided sense of penitence. Floyd was silent for a few moments as he attempted to get his brain around everything Auger had told him. But you told me you're from 22, whatever it was, he said eventually. If all this happened in the middle of the 21st century, there's still quite a lot of history you haven't told me about yet, surely. 200 years of it, Auger said, but I'll spare you the details. Really, not much has happened. The same political groupings still exist. We control access to Earth, and the Slashers control access to the rest of the galaxy. Most of the time, it's been reasonably peaceable. Most of the time. We had a couple of small disagreements. The Slashers keep trying to repair the Earth, with or without our consent. So far, they've only made things worse. There's a whole ecology of machines down there now. The last time they tried, 23 years ago, we ended up having a small war over access rights. It's turned messy, really messy, but we patched things up afterwards. It's just a shame about what happened to Mars. Nice to see wars haven't gone out of fashion, Floyd said. Auger nodded sadly. But in the last few months, things have turned sour again. That's why I wasn't exactly thrilled to discover a Slasher presence in your Paris. It tells me that they're up to something, and that makes me worried. I can't help but think it has to be bad news. Wait, Floyd said. There's something I need to get straight here. A few hours ago, you told me you were not a time traveler. That's right, Auger said, tight-lipped. But you keep on telling me you're from the future, he said, born in the year 22, whatever. You've even given me a history lesson about some of the events that have occurred between my time and yours. Mad weather, mad machines, people living in space.
Yes, Orga said helpfully, raising an eyebrow.
Then you must have traveled back to the present. Why pretend otherwise? This ship must be your time machine, or whatever you want to call it. Are you taking me back to the future?
She looked at him hard.
What year is it, Floyd?
It's 1959, he said.
No, she said, it isn't. It's 2266, more than 300 years into what you think of as the future.
You mean it will be when we come out of the other end of this thing? Or have we somehow already entered the future?
No, she said, with an infinite and alarming patience. It isn't 1959 now. It wasn't 1959 yesterday, and it wasn't 1959 when we met last week.
Now you're making even less sense than usual.
I'm saying that your whole existence is...
She grasped for words that would make sense to him.
Something other than what you think it is. On one level, it's not even true to say that you are Wendell Floyd.
Maybe the robot should have put you under after all. You're starting to sound feverish.
I wish it was a fever. That would make life a lot easier for all concerned.
Not least for me.
Floyd scratched at his bandage, wondering if the delusional one was himself. His arm floated free, light as a balloon. It was as if they were falling, as if in a dream. He was going to wake up, back in his room in Rue du Dragon, and laugh all this off with Custine over bad coffee and burnt toast. One bump on the head too many, that was his problem. But he kept on not waking up.
So let's start with me, he said. Start with this poor sap named Wendell Floyd. Explain how it is that I might not even be who I think I am.
Wendell Floyd is dead, Orga said. He died hundreds of years ago.
That was when an alarm started buzzing somewhere in the cabin. Floyd's hand reached for the joystick, ready to nudge the ship back on course. But Orga shook her head, holding up three fingers in warning.
This is different, she said. The guidance system is still online.
Then what's the problem?
I'm not sure. They only gave me the idiot's guide to flying this thing.
Orga threw banks of switches, making the screens light up with different numbers and diagrams. Nothing she did made the audible alarm turn off.
Any clues? Floyd asked.
I don't think there's anything wrong with the ship, she said. Everything looks good, or at least acceptable, on all boards, and it doesn't look as though it has anything to do with the tunnel geometry ahead of us.
What then?
She threw more toggles, tapping the nail of an index finger against one of the screens and frowning at the avalanche of tiny digits and letters.
Not good, she said. Not good at all.
Just tell me, Floyd said, frustration beginning to well up in his voice.
Something's coming up behind us. That's what this alarm is telling us. The proximity system is picking up some kind of rearward echo. I can't read the numbers well enough to work out what it is, but it could be another ship.
How could there be another ship?
I don't know, she said. Believe me, I wish I did. The tunnel is vacuum sealed at the Paris end. Even if it was somehow possible to get two ships into it at the same time, and I'm not even sure the mathematics allows that, then it still can't have happened. There is no other ship in the E2 recovery bubble. We should be the only rat in this drainpipe.
Something else, then? Another machine, but not necessarily a ship?
I don't know. Maybe it's some debris we dropped behind us. It was a bumpy insertion, and some stuff probably got knocked off the ship. It might be following us, sucked along in our wake, if we have a wake.
But why would we not have seen it until now in that case?
That's a damn good question, she said under her breath, as if he was the last person in the world she wanted to know it.
29. Presently, Orga found a way to turn off the audible alarm. Floyd breathed a sigh of relief when the din ended, and they were left with the usual churn of cabin background sounds. There was something soothingly maritime about those noises. They made him think of engine rooms, the distant reassuring throb of diesel power.
I wish they'd told me how to interpret this junk, Orga said, lines of concentration furrowing her forehead as she stared at the streaming numbers.
It's almost as if the damned echo is getting closer. But that can't be the case, can it?
I'll take your word for it, Floyd said, shrugging helplessly.
If it was debris, it wouldn't be getting any nearer. We should have lost most of it when we slid through the interchange cavern, and given all the uncontrolled collisions it would be experiencing against the tunnel walls, it should be losing ground on us, not gaining it. There also shouldn't be a lot left of it by now. So scratch the debris theory. Maybe you're misreading those numbers, Floyd offered. Or maybe there's something wrong with the ship, making it imagine there's something behind it when there isn't.
I'd really like to believe that, she said.
You might be getting worked up over nothing. Fact is, from the little that you've told me, there isn't a whole lot we can do except sit back and enjoy the ride. That's more or less the case, isn't it?
Somehow that doesn't make it any easier to live with.
Then I'll try to take your mind off things until you can make some more sense of those numbers. We were talking about me, I think. Specifically about how I didn't actually happen to exist.
Maybe we shouldn't go there, Floyd.
Orga could not snap her attention from the puzzling barrage of numbers. She kept staring at them with a poised alertness, like someone expecting a flash of gold in a mountain stream. It was a mistake to tell you what I did.
Sorry, kid, but you already opened that particular can of worms. It kind of gives a fella the creeps to hear someone talking as if he died years ago. Are you going to elaborate? Or do I have to turn on the charm?
Not the charm, Floyd. I'm not sure I could take it.
Then tell me about these rumors of my death. When exactly did they nail me into a box?
I don't know, she said, and I don't even know for sure that you rated a box. I'm afraid Wendell Floyd simply didn't make enough of a dent in history for that detail to have survived.
Remind me how old you are, Floyd.
40? 41?
39. You really know how to flatter a guy.
So you were born, when? Sometime around 1920?
Spot on, Floyd said.
Which would have made Floyd 80 by the end of the century. But chances are he didn't get to see the year 2000. He might well have died during the Second World War, or perhaps he lived a happy and peaceful life into old age and passed on surrounded by loving family members. Or maybe he ended his days as some crabby antisocial bastard everyone couldn't wait to see the back of.
I've always had a sneaking regard for crabby antisocial bastards, Floyd said.
Whatever happened, Orga said, it was a human life. He was born, he lived, he died. He probably made some people happy and other people unhappy. He was probably remembered for a few decades after he died. After that, he'd just have been a face in old photographs, the kind that come out when you spring clean and you can't quite remember where they came from or who's who, and that was it. Wendell Floyd, he lived, he died. It was a life. End of story.
Why do I have the feeling that someone just walked over my grave?
Because someone probably did, Orga said, or they would have, if your grave wasn't buried under a few hundred meters of ice.
Where did the ice come into it?
I told you the Earth got screwed up. But never mind the ice. What matters is that at some point during the late 1930s, something happened to Wendell Floyd.
A lot of things happened in the late 1930s, Floyd said.
But the main event is one that you won't remember at all. No one does. But the funny thing is that it happened to everyone at the same instant, and it was the most important thing that ever happened to them in their whole lives, and yet it went utterly unremarked.
It happened to everyone?
To everyone who was alive whenever exactly it happened. Everything that was alive. Every animal and plant on the planet, and every inanimate thing as well. Every grain of sand on every beach, every blade of grass, every drop of water in every ocean, every molecule of oxygen in the atmosphere, every atom in every rock, all the way to the Earth's core.
So what was this incredible thing that happened?
It was like a photograph, she said, like the instant when the flash goes off and the image is burnt onto the plate. Except it wasn't a simple picture. It was a three-dimensional one, an image of astonishing, mind-blowing complexity. A photograph of the entire planet, down to the quantum horizon of information capture. Maybe even beyond Heisenberg. Who knows? Our physics doesn't even hint at how they did it. We call it a quantum snapshot, but that doesn't mean we have clue one about what was involved in producing it. That's just a name we give it to hide our ignorance.
But no one could have done such a thing, Floyd said. We'd have heard about it. It would have been all over the headlines.
It wasn't done by any agency on Earth. The snapshot was taken by an external power. Beings from another planet, or another dimension, or another time. We have no idea what they were like or what motivated them to do this. Only that it happened.
Martians again?
Not Martians. Probably not even anything we'd recognize as an intelligent entity. They must have been far ahead of us, Floyd. About as far ahead of us as we're ahead of sponges or beetles. Godlike in every sense. And they came along and took this photograph. The snapshot. Like I said, we don't know how. Maybe they built a structure around the entire planet in a matter of hours. A clever, subtle structure, which was somehow able to make the recording in an eye blink, without anyone noticing, and, more importantly, without significantly affecting the planet itself in any way. Or maybe they just kissed something against the planet, another object that became entangled with the quantum identity of the Earth, encoding all that information into itself, ready to be deciphered again in the future. We could speculate about the how forever and never get close to the truth. What we can guess at more successfully, perhaps, is the why. We think their motives were fundamentally benign. They were interested in preservation, in creating a record of the Earth that could be used to recreate the planet in the event of a future catastrophe. We call that the backup copy theory. According to that view, the entities that did this are like cosmic archivists or system administrators. They go around the galaxy, visiting worlds that are at a sensitive stage of evolution, and they make copies using the quantum snapshot process. And what happens to these copies? Floyd asked. That's the big question. Our best guess, and there is some intelligence to support this, is that the copies are dispersed throughout the galaxy, preserved in a kind of storage media. Think of these storage media as safety deposit boxes, each of which contains a single photograph. One might be the image of Earth at a particular moment in the late 1930s. Another might contain a snapshot of Earth from 65 million years ago, or the ancient history of another planet entirely. We think we've found some of these boxes. We call them anomalous large structures, or ALS spheres. They're stellar-sized objects of obvious alien origin, huge armored spheres vast enough to contain entire planets and a sizable volume of space around them. Have you looked inside any of these boxes? The best anyone has been able to do was take a fuzzy image of the contents of one sphere. Embedded inside, coincidental with the geometric center, was a dense object with just the kind of neutrino absorption cross-section that you'd expect from a rocky world. It wasn't any planet we recognized, based on its implied density and size. Floyd risked a contribution. A snapshot of another world. Yes, frozen inside the structure like a perfect three-dimensional photograph. Of course, if we scoured the galaxy thoroughly enough, we'd eventually find the original, the world from which the copy was made, assuming we were able to recognize it when we found it. Tell me how all this fits together. Why would anyone want to make copies of planets and put them inside giant eggshells? And what the hell does it have to do with me? Haven't you figured it out yet? She said with a snarl of irritation. Floyd was copied. Him and every living person on the planet. After the snapshot was taken, he went on to live whatever life it was he lived. History rolled on, and the world ended in 2077, and that should have been the end of it. But now Floyd's copy has come back to life somehow, hundreds of years later, and I'm talking to it, at this exact moment, trying to explain to it why it isn't who it thinks it is. She said each and every it with deliberate, wounding emphasis. I can't be a copy, Floyd said. I remember everything. I remember what I did when I was a kid and everything I did afterwards, until now. That doesn't prove anything. You were copied with all of Floyd's memories intact, down to the last detail. Wait a minute. If the copy was made a few hundred years ago, why isn't the copy dead by now? You should be dead, Orga said, and you would be if the copy had been allowed to live immediately after the snapshot was produced, but it wasn't. The copy, the complete three-dimensional image of the Earth and its inhabitants, appears to have remained frozen until about 23 years ago, held in some kind of suspended quantum state. Floyd saw her close her eyes as she groped for a simile. Like an undeveloped photograph, she offered. But someone came along and developed it. Yes, quantum states like that are very fragile, and a copy of an entire planet must be astonishingly fragile, a house of cards just waiting to collapse at the merest sneeze. But somehow, whoever created it was able to isolate it to a sufficient degree to preserve it for a while. The weak radiation signals that came through the shell, the gravitational and neutrino emissions, obviously weren't enough to upset the stasis, or whatever you want to call it. But still, there was some kind of trigger. By your calendar, it was 1959 when we met, agreed?
Yes.
We also know, from studying historical events in your timeline, that your world was on more or less the right track until at least the mid-30s. By the end of 1940, it had changed. The German invasion in May of that year failed, which implies a build-up of small events over a period of years that eventually had a significant impact. Most likely, the snapshot took place somewhere around 1936, 23 years ago as far as you're concerned.
If you say so, Floyd said grudgingly, conceding nothing.
Now, look at the same span of time in our chronology. We know that time passes at the same rate in your world as it does in mine. It's 2266 now. Subtract 23 years, and we're back in 2243, which is more or less when the Slashers had control of Mars and its moons, including Phobos.
Where we're headed, Floyd added, as if only to show that he was paying attention.
Yes, and I can't believe that's a coincidence. My guess is that the snapshot began to evolve forward in time from the moment the Slashers opened the portal on Phobos. A little bit of the external universe must have begun to leak into the ALS, collapsing the image into a normal state of matter. The snapshot came alive. In his mind's eye, Floyd had a sudden, horrible mental image. He pictured a kind of theatrical stage populated by stiff mechanical dancers, still as statues, coated in years' worth of dust. And then they began to move, slowly at first, choreographing their clockwork movements to music from a grindingly slow fairground organ. As the tortured, wheezing music gained speed, so did the dancers, whirling and gyrating in orbits and epicycles. He tried to shake the image, but the little figures danced on, gaining speed.
But even if that were true, Floyd said, even if I and everyone I know had been kept asleep for all those years, all those hundreds of years, shouldn't we remember it?
You wouldn't remember a damn thing, Auger said. You skipped over 300-odd years between heartbeats, Floyd, you and everyone else on the planet. Maybe you felt the tiniest moment of déjà vu, or some other thing the French have a word for, but that would have been it.
Everyone on the planet would have felt it.
Maybe, but how many of you would have even thought to remark on it?
You can't expect me just to accept this, he said.
Floyd, I'm not asking you to accept anything.
She sounded for a moment desperately sorry for him. Hearing that in her voice only made him more afraid that she was indeed telling the truth and nothing more.
I'm not a copy of Wendell Floyd, he said, panic rising in his voice despite his attempts to keep it under control. I am Wendell Floyd. You're a perfect copy. That's precisely how you would feel.
Then what does that make me? Some kind of ghost? Some kind of phony imitation?
That's the way some people might see it.
And is that the way you see it?
No, she said, after just too much hesitation. Not at all.
Now I know why you were so worried that I wouldn't be able to pass through that sensor thing, Floyd said.
I couldn't know what would happen. No one had tried to bring anyone out of E2 before. It treated me like any other human being. Isn't that good enough for you?
Yes, she said.
I suppose it is. But listen to me, Floyd. You will never belong in my world. Your world is back in Paris, as real or otherwise as it might be.
Don't worry, he told her. I have every intention of returning.
Something caught her eye again, some glint of meaning in the tumble of numbers racing across the display screens. She flipped banks of switches, peered at the numbers again. Her face was a mask of intense, troubled concentration.
It's still getting closer? Floyd asked.
I'm worried about this. It almost looks as if...
But then she shook her head, as if trying to dislodge whatever upsetting thought had taken up residence.
It can't be.
What can't be?
I might be making a mistake here, she said.
I'll take the risk. What's got you so rattled?
I think what I'm seeing is the end of the tunnel behind us. It's acting like a reflecting surface, bouncing signals back towards us.
But we left Paris behind hours ago.
I know. And I think something bad must have happened just as we left. The numbers make it look as if the tunnel's collapsing, folding shut just behind us.
Can that happen?
I guess so. Skelskad always said there might be a problem if the throat contracted too quickly during an insertion. It looks as if the robot couldn't handle the injection procedure, or else it was programmed to find the one solution that would get us out of Paris, even if that meant sacrificing the link and itself.
What does that mean?
It means we're sliding down a pipe that's getting shorter all the while, with the closed end catching up with us.
That doesn't sound good to me.
It doesn't sound good to me, either. Orga tapped a finger against another display. But these numbers back me up. They show our speed through the hyperweb with our estimated ETA at Phobos. We're picking up momentum, shaving hours off our projected journey time.
Isn't that a good thing?
No, because it's nothing that the transport is doing, and it can't be due to another ship or pile of debris behind us. It must be due to something pretty fundamental happening to the hyperweb. I think it's the field geometry in the walls, squeezing us forward like a pip. As the crimped end gets nearer and nearer, we're being pushed along faster and faster by the enclosing walls.
She turned to Floyd.
But the ship isn't built to handle speeds much faster than this, and I don't know what will happen when the curvature becomes really severe and we end up squeezed into the end of the tunnel.
Is there anything we can do about it?
Not much, Orga said. I could fire the steering jets, try to push us away from whatever is following us, but the jets aren't designed for sustained use. We'd buy a few minutes, maybe half an hour.
We're in a heap of trouble, aren't we?
Yes, Orga said, and I'm shot and not feeling at my sharpest. But we'll get out of this. Don't you worry.
You sound rather sure of yourself.
I didn't come all this way for nothing, she said, a frown of determination etched firmly into her forehead. I'm not going to let a little space-time difficulty spoil my day.
Why don't you get some rest? Floyd said. See if you can catch some sleep before things get too bumpy.
I think I can just about cope with the ship at the moment.
Are you a good driver, Floyd?
No, he said. I'm a lousy driver. Christine always says I drive like a grandmother on Sunday.
Well, that fills me with confidence, she said, reluctantly releasing control of the ship to Floyd and trying to relax.
Floyd took the joystick, feeling the slight lurch as the ship fell under his control. Perhaps it was his imagination, but the ride already felt rougher. It was as if they had left a smooth stretch of road and were now rumbling over a dirt track. Around the cabin, the fixed instruments and displays appeared slightly blurred. He squinted, but that did nothing to make the view clearer. Somewhere behind the metal paneling of the cabin, something made a shrill, tinny, vibrating sound, as if it was about to work loose. Floyd tightened his grip on the joystick, wondering how bad things were going to get before they got better.
30. Orga woke to intense turbulence, the ship shaking and shimmying as if only an instant away from swift annihilation. Through blurred, gummed eyes, she glanced at the principal instruments, remembering as much as she could of Skelskad's technical briefing. The situation was acute, far, far worse than when she had gone to sleep. According to the numbers, and again, a lot depended on her imperfect interpretation of those dancing, tumbling digits, the collapsing end of the tunnel had almost caught up with them. Simultaneously, it had accelerated them even faster. It was as if they were caught in the pressure wave in front of an avalanche, pushed ahead, but with an ever-dwindling lead that would soon see them engulfed. The ship was showing signs of mortal damage. Many displays were simply dead or showing only static. Some dials were inactive, jammed against their limits. Others were wheeling around like dervishes, spinning like the altimeter in a dive bomber. The guidance display on her side of the cabin revealed ragged blind spots in the flowing contours of its stress energy grid. In her mind's eye, she visualized critical machinery sensors and guidance mechanisms ripped clean away from the hull, trailing sizzling hot electrical ganglia with them. Warning lights were flashing, and yet the klaxons were mysteriously silent.
Floyd, she said, her mouth sluggish and dry. How long was I under?
A few hours, he said. He still had his hand on the joystick, and as she watched, he made tiny, precise adjustments.
A few. It feels like...
More than a few? It was probably more like 6, or maybe even 12. I don't know. I guess I lost count. He looked at her, his face a study in exhaustion. How do you feel, kid?
Better, she said, rubbing experimentally at the wound. Groggy. Sore. But better. The UR must have eased the inflammation, taken care of the bleeding. Does that mean you'll hold together until we reach the end of this funfair ride?
Should do, she said.
But you'll still need help when we arrive.
Yes, but don't worry about that. If we get there, they'll take care of me.
The ship veered violently, then knocked hard against something and slid on a sideways trajectory with an ominous bone-crunching rumble. Floyd grimaced and pulled the joystick hard over. Auger heard the sequenced pop of the steering jets and wondered how much propellant Floyd had already consumed holding them together until now.
I was out for 12 hours, she said, his words just sinking in.
Maybe 13, but don't worry about me. The time simply flew by.
You did good getting us this far, Floyd. Seriously, I'm impressed.
He looked at her with a genuine and rather touching surprise, as if the last thing he had been expecting was praise.
Really?
Yes, really. Not bad for a man who shouldn't exist. I just hope the effort will turn out to have been worth it.
You're still worried about what will happen at the other end?
We're going to pop out of this tunnel much faster than the system was ever designed to deal with, like an express train hitting the buffers at full tilt.
You have a bunch of people at the other end, right? People like Skelskard.
Yes, she said, but I don't know how much good they're going to be able to do, even if we could warn them.
But we can't even get a message through to them. You can't bounce signals up the pipe while there's a ship in it. Not according to the book, anyway.
Won't they have any warning at all?
Maybe. Skelskard has equipment to monitor the condition of the link, but I don't know if it's going to be able to tell her that the link itself is collapsing. But she also told me about something called bow shock distortion. It's like a ripple we push ahead of ourselves, a change in the geometry of the tunnel propagating ahead of the transport. They have equipment to pick it up, so that they can tell when a ship is about to come through the portal.
I think it gives them a few minutes' warning.
Auger scratched at a crusty residue that had collected in the corner of one eye. It felt dense and geologic, hard and compacted like some motherlode of granite.
But that won't help us, she said. They'll have even less warning than usual because we're going so much faster than we should be.
There must be something we can do, Floyd said.
Yes, Auger said. We can pray, and hope that the tunnel doesn't speed us up any faster than we're already moving. Right now, we might just walk out of this alive. Any faster, and I think we've had it.
If we get to that point, would you mind not telling me? The coward in me would rather not know.
The coward in both of us, Auger said. If it's any consolation, Floyd, it'll be quick and spectacular.
She checked out the numbers again. No active denial could avoid the fact that they were now traveling 30% faster than the ship she'd taken on the inbound leg of the journey. The ETA now had the total trip taking less than 22 hours. Of that time, about 16 hours had already passed, and they were not getting any slower.
Floyd, she said, do you want to take a break? I can fly the ship for a while.
In your condition? Thanks, but I think I can keep my eyes open for a few hours more.
Trust me. It's going to take both of us to get this thing home.
Floyd studied her for a moment and then nodded, relaxed his grip on the joystick, and almost immediately slumped back into his couch and into a deep sleep. It was as if he had given himself permission to slip into unconsciousness, after holding it at bay for so long by a sheer act of will. Auger wondered how many hours at sea had honed that particular skill, and wished him sweet dreams, assuming that he had the energy to dream. Perhaps unconsciousness would be the kindest state for both of them to be in when the end approached.
Find a way out of this, she said aloud, as if that might help.
The 4 hours that followed were the longest she could remember. She had taken the last of the UR pills, hoping that this was the right thing to do. For the first hour, she felt a shrill, slightly unnerving clarity of mind. It was like the ringing caused by a finger circling the wet rim of a wine glass. It felt fragile and not quite trustworthy, making her wonder if she was indeed making the right decisions, even when they felt absolutely unquestionably correct. When, at last, that bell-clear intensity began to dull, and she started to feel foggy-headed, unable to focus on any particular problem for more than a few seconds, it came as a kind of relief. At least now she had objective evidence that her thought processes were likely to be impaired. She could factor that dullness into her activities, allowing for it wherever possible. It was, she supposed, a measure of her lessening hold on reality that she could even consider this a minor victory. The ship was moving even faster now, 50% above conventional tunnel speeds, and still accelerating.
By now, Auger had enough of a grasp of the numbers to estimate their emergence speed, and the news was not cheering. They would hit the Phobos portal at twice the expected rate, and even that was likely to be an underestimate, since the rate of acceleration was itself beginning to quicken as the geometry of the pinch tunnel underwent convulsive readjustments. The apparatus in the recovery bubble would never be able to cope with that kind of momentum. The transport would smash through the arrestor cradle and the glass sphere of the bubble, then smear itself against the plasticized walls of the chamber a couple of kilometers inside Phobos. It would be a very lucky day if anyone made it out of that mess alive, let alone Auger and Floyd. Spectacular? Hell yes. But the speed hurt them in other ways. The forward-looking sensors had already been damaged by tunnel collisions, but even in those areas that were not affected by blind spots, the sensors could not peer far enough ahead to give ample warning of micro-changes in the tunnel structure. Obstacles and wrinkles that the guidance system could normally have coped with, steering around them with finessed calibrated fuel-conserving bursts of steering thrust, now came upon the ship too quickly for it to respond in time. The ship was still managing to dodge the worst of them, but the effort was draining the steering jets at a worrying rate. But even that was not the main thing on Auger's mind. For a while, she did not even think about the problem of slowing down, or the bullet in her shoulder, or the slasher activity in Paris. She thought about Floyd, and how she was going to explain things to him. Because with the tunnel unzipping behind them, Floyd was going to find it very difficult to make his way home. There would no longer be a hyperweb connection between Phobos and Paris. No way for him to make that return trip. Even if the two of them somehow survived the next few hours, and she preferred not to think about the odds of that, Floyd would still find himself marooned countless light-years from E2 and, more importantly, 3 centuries upstream in a future that didn't even regard him as a genuine human being, rather a very detailed living and breathing copy of one. A copy of a man who had lived and died in a time when the world still had a chance to fix the mess it was in. A man so happily ordinary that he hadn't left the faintest trace of himself in history. Around 2 hours after he had slipped into unconsciousness, Floyd stirred beside her. There was no telling what had woken him. It could have been the increasingly rough ride, or the emergency klaxon that had just come on, accompanied by a recorded female voice, calmly informing them that they were about to lose steering control. "Is that as bad as it sounds?" Floyd asked.
"No," Auger said. "It's worse. A lot worse."
The guidance system had depleted most of the reaction mass in the steering jets. What was left would be good for about 10 minutes, at most. Less if their speed kept increasing, which it showed every intention of doing. By Auger's reckoning, the pinch at the end of the tunnel had nearly caught up with them, and the pinch was still showing definite signs of acceleration. Maybe if she had Skelskard's grasp of hyperweb theory, imperfect as it was, she might have been able to explain why that was happening and how it related to the underlying metric structure of the collapsing quasi-wormhole. Not that such knowledge would have been particularly useful in any practical sense, but... "If we can't steer," Floyd said, "won't we crash into the walls? I mean, more than we've already been doing?"
"Yes," Auger said, "but the system reckons that we're only 1 hour from Phobos now, maybe less, depending on how much more we accelerate. There's a faint chance that the ship might hold together long enough to get us there, even with complete loss of guidance control. Emphasis on the faint.
I won't pencil in anything for next week.
It's going to be bumpy, worse than anything we've experienced so far, and we'll still have the small problem of hitting the portal at 2.5 times normal tunnel speed, even if we make it that far.
Let's just deal with one thing at a time, shall we? That friend of yours, Skelskard?"
"Yes," Auger said.
She sounded as if she knew what she was doing. "She'll find a way out of this, if we can hold together until the end."
Poor Floyd, she thought. If only you knew what things are really like. The future might have been crammed with miracles and wonders, but it also offered truly awesome opportunities for screwing up. "I'm sure you're right," she said, doing her best to sound reassuring. "I'm sure they'll think of something."
"That's the spirit."
"Final warning," the soothing feminine voice said. "Attitude adjustment control will cease in 10, 9, 8.
Brace yourself, Floyd. And if you have any lucky charms, now might be the time to start sweet-talking them.
Attitude adjustment control is now offline, the voice said, with a kind of cheery resignation. For a deceptive 10 or 20 seconds, the ride became dreamily smooth again. It was as if they had tobogganed off the edge of a cliff into the absolute stillness of midair.
Hey,
Floyd started to say. That's not too... Then they hit something, the side of the ship grazing hard against the tunnel wall. It was a bigger jolt than anything they had experienced so far. They felt and heard an awful wrench as something large and metallic was plucked from the hull. Floyd grabbed the joystick and tried to correct their trajectory, but nothing he did had any effect on the oozing contours of the stress-energy display. It's useless, Auger said, with a stoic calm that even she found surprising. We're in uncontrolled flight now. To emphasize this point, she released her own dead joystick and folded back the control console. Just sit back and enjoy the ride. You're going to give up that easily? What if there's still some fuel left in the tanks? This isn't a war film, Floyd. When the system says zero, it means it. After the first collision, there was another hiatus as the transport rebounded to the other side of the tunnel. Auger still kept an eye on the grid and the cascading numbers. The ship's nose was beginning to point away from the direction of forward motion. There was going to be another bad jolt when they... The impact came sooner than she had anticipated. It slammed through her like an electrical shock, snapping her jaw shut. She bit her tongue, tasted blood in her mouth. Warning lights flashed all around the cockpit. One of the surviving klaxons came on, barking a two-tone scream into her skull. Another taped voice, it sounded suspiciously like the same woman, said, "Caution! Safe design limits for outer hull integrity have now been exceeded. Structural failure is now a high likelihood event." "Hey, lady," Floyd said, "tell us something we don't know." But Auger had no idea how to turn off the automated voice messages. Almost as soon as the first one had ended, another chimed in, informing them that safe radiation limits for the crew had now been exceeded. Then they hit again, and rebounded, and hit again, and then the nose of the transport came around through 60 degrees, so that the next kick imparted a sickening roll to their motion, which only became worse with the next collision. With each rotation, Auger was pushed into her seat and then dragged out of it, her entire body straining against the webbing. The wound in her shoulder, numb for hours, now began to reassert its presence. The stress-energy contours were flowing too fast to read, the interpretive system just as confused as Auger. Not that it made a damned bit of difference. When you had lost all control, flying blind was almost a mercy. Something else was ripped away from the hull with a squeal of tortured metal. She felt a pop in her skull as the air pressure suddenly notched down. "We just lost..." She did not have time to complete her sentence. Air shrieked out of the cabin, becoming thinner with every breath. Through blurred eyes, she saw Floyd's panicked expression as his body was buffeted to and fro by the same car-wheeling motion that was shoving her in and out of her seat. She struggled to reach her good arm up, feeling as if she had to push a boulder out of the way. Her hand closed around the striped yellow toggle of the emergency mask hatch. She pulled it down, cursing the system that should have dropped the mask automatically. She pressed the hard plastic of the mask to her face and took a cold and instantly reinvigorating breath. She motioned for Floyd to do the same and waited impatiently while he located his mask and slipped it on gratefully. "Can you hear me?" she asked. "Yes," he said at last, but his voice sounded thin and distant. "The blowout's stabilized. I think we're down to about a third of normal operating pressure. We'll need to keep..." The words were jolted away from her as the careering, tumbling ship smashed itself against the wall again. She heard more chunks of hull ripping away. Most of the displays were by now either dead or showing nothing comprehensible. Auger tried to focus on the ETA, but even that kept changing, varying by tens of minutes with each rotation as the ship reinterpreted its tunnel speed. Another jolt followed, sending a compression wave up her backbone that whiplashed her skull against the back of the seat. She blacked out for an instant, drifting back to consciousness through a bloody haze of red-tinged tunnel vision. Her hands seemed impossibly distant and ineffectual, anchored to her body by the thinnest of threads. Her thoughts were foggy, unfocused. She was dreaming this, surely. No, she wasn't. She was in it. But even the prospect of imminent death had lost some of its edge now. Perhaps blacking out really wasn't such a bad option after all.
She looked at Floyd and saw his head lolling from one side of the chair to the other as the ship rotated. His mouth was open, as if in a gasp of ecstasy or dread. His eyes were narrow, pink-tinged slits, and fresh blood seeped from beneath his bandage. Floyd was out cold. The ship kept tumbling, tumbling and crashing and slowly dying. Orga tried to press herself more tightly into her seat, clutching the armrests and stiffening her torso against the padded back. From a distance, as if from another room, a woman's voice said, "Warning! Final approach to portal in progress. Final approach to portal in progress. Please ensure all systems are stowed and all crew members are braced for deceleration procedure. Failure to comply..." "Please shut the fuck up," Orga said, and then prayed for unconsciousness. The jolting and buffeting reached a climax. There was an instant, it couldn't have lasted more than 2 or 3 seconds, when it seemed completely impossible that either the ship or its fragile human cargo would survive the next few heartbeats. The rapidity and severity of the collisions were just too severe. But the end never came. The tumbling continued, but, with the exception of the occasional thud or bump, the brutal collisions ceased. Even the tumbling settled down, becoming regular and almost tolerable. Once again, it was as if the transport had sailed off the edge of a precipice and was now in a deceptive freefall, a spiteful remission from the damaging impacts that were bound to resume at any moment. But they didn't.
"Numbers," Orga mumbled through a bloodied, swollen tongue.
But the numbers told her nothing. The ship had finally become blind and senseless, unable to assemble any coherent picture of its surroundings. A change in the tunnel geometry, Orga thought, that was the only thing that could explain what had just happened. The collapse process must have somehow caused the end of the tunnel near the throat they were approaching to swell wider, increasing the diameter of the tunnel so that the transport had much further to travel between impacts with the sides. She could think of no other explanation. They had certainly not undergone the crushing deceleration that would have been necessary to halt them within the recovery bubble, and they were still tumbling. The ship hadn't been caught or snared or arrested by anything. But the tunnel would have had to swell ludicrously wide. They hadn't suffered a serious impact for at least 2 minutes, just those minor knocks. Had the picture changed so dramatically that those were, in fact, the glancing impacts? Had the tunnel walls become softer somehow, better able to absorb the collisions? Another thud, and then something even stranger, a drum-like pitter-patter of tinier thuds like rain. Then nothing. Floyd made a groaning noise.
"I wish those elephants would stop sitting on my head," he said.
"Are you all right? What do you remember?"
"I remember thinking I needed a new career."
He touched the side of his head, straining to hold up his hand against the centrifugal effect of their tumbling motion.
"Are we dead yet? Or is it just me who feels that way?"
"We're not dead," she answered. "But I don't know why not. We haven't had a major collision for a few minutes, but we're still spinning."
"I noticed. You have a theory for this state of affairs?"
"No," she said. "Nothing that makes any sense." It was, she realized, very quiet. The ship made little creaking and groaning sounds, but there were no klaxons blaring, no pre-recorded voices announcing impending disaster. It was exactly as if they were tumbling through...
"Can you make sense of those numbers?" Floyd asked, interrupting her train of thought.
"No," she said. "The ship hasn't got a clue where it is. What it's showing would only make sense if we'd left the portal behind, which, obviously..."
"Maybe if we opened the window shields, we might have a better idea," Floyd suggested.
"You opened those windows in mid-tunnel, you'll be wearing dark glasses for the rest of your life."
"I always thought they suited me. Can't you crank the blinds open just a crack? It might tell us something."
She groped for an objection, but found none that she thought likely to convince him. Besides, he was right. At the very least, it would tell them something, even if the information had no practical value. But she would still rather know where she was. It was, she supposed, a basic human need. "I don't even know if they'll open," she said, "after the pounding we took back there."
"Just try it, Auger."
She folded down the control console and found the switch that operated the armored window shutters. Just when she had convinced herself that nothing was going to happen, that the shutters must be buckled tight, a fan of hard light cleaved the cabin in two. One of the shutters was broken, but the other was still operational. She allowed it to open to the width of 3 fingers,
then held it at that position. She squinted, raising a hand to shield her eyes. After more than a day in the subdued lighting of the cabin, the glare was intensely bright, but it was not the murderous electric blue radiance of the tunnel. The light blinked out. The light returned. "It's timed with our rotation," she said after a moment. "It's as if there's a light source to one side of us, rather than all around us. Does that make any sense?" "No, but then neither does the fact that we're alive." Floyd's seat was positioned too far from the window to let him see through it. "Can you see anything you recognize?" he asked. "No," Auger said. She allowed the shutter to open to its fullest extent, but she could still only tell that there was a light source somewhere outside. "I'm going to leave my seat. See if I can get my head closer to—" "Easy, soldier. That's not a job for someone in your condition." Floyd was already trying to extricate himself from his seat harness, his fingers sliding over the complex plastic buckles. "You can talk." The harness released him. The tumbling continued, but because it was now regular and confined to one axis of rotation, Floyd was able to push himself out of the seat without too much difficulty. He used one arm to brace himself against the cabin wall, and another to lever himself closer to the window, keeping one foot hooked around the rest at the base of the seat. "Careful, Floyd," Auger said, as he pressed his face to the glass. "Do you see anything out there?" "There's a bright light off to one side," he said. "I can't see it directly, but there is something else out there."
"Describe it."
"It comes into view once every rotation. It's like—" He adjusted his position, the effort etched in his face. "A bright smudge, like a cloud with lights in it. Lights around it, as a matter of fact. Some of them moving, some of them flashing. There are dark things in front of the cloud moving outwards." She tried to visualize whatever it was he was seeing and drew a comprehensive blank.
"That's it? That's all you can see?"
"That's about the size of it."
"Well, what color is it?"
Floyd looked back at her. "I don't know. I'm not exactly the guy to ask when it comes to colors."
"You mean you're colorblind?"
Despite her fears, she couldn't help but laugh.
"Hey, isn't that a little rude?"
"I'm not laughing at you, Floyd. I'm laughing at us. We make quite a pair, don't we? The colorblind detective and the tone-deaf spy. Actually, I meant to ask you about—" But Floyd trailed off. "Auger, you may not want to hear this, but damned if that thing doesn't seem to be getting smaller." Whatever Floyd was seeing, it bore no relationship to anything Auger had been told to expect during her mission briefing. It meant, surely, that something very odd and unanticipated had happened to them. She felt a prickle of comprehension, like an itch at the back of her head.
"Floyd, I think I have an idea.
There's something else out there as well. It's very big. I can just see the edge of it."
"Floyd, I think we slipped into a different part of the hyperweb. Skelskard said there was no way any other tunnel could intersect with the one we were in, but what if she was wrong?"
Auger forced herself to calm down and speak more slowly.
"What if there was a junction, and we found it by accident when we were bouncing around back there? Or what if we hit the wall so hard we actually punctured it and slipped through into an adjacent part of the network?"
"Are you listening to me, Auger?" Floyd said, staring at her as if she'd gone completely insane. "I'm telling you there's something really, really big out there."
"The light source?"
"No, not the light source. It's on the other side of the sky. It almost looks like—" Auger reached out to the console panel again.
"Get back in your seat. I'm going to try something hopelessly optimistic."
"My kind of girl. What are you going to do?"
"I'm going to see if there's any juice left in those steering jets."
"We already tried that," Floyd said, lowering himself back into his seat and pulling the harness tight. "They died on us."
"I know, but the system might have been reading empty even when there was a tiny amount of pressure left in the reservoir."
Floyd gave her an odd look. "You said it didn't work like that."
"I lied. I swatted down your suggestion because I was feeling nasty and petulant. Not that it would have done us much good back then anyway."
"Of course not." He sounded hurt.
"I'm sorry," she said. "I'm not dealing with this very well, okay? Believe it or not, this isn't a situation I find myself in every day."
"Consider yourself forgiven," Floyd said.
"Look," Auger said, "all I need is a couple of squirts of reaction mass, just enough to kill our spin, or even simply to alter it so that we have a different view."
"You might make things worse."
I think we have to risk it. Her hand closed on the joystick. She flipped up the trigger guard and readied her finger, trying to picture the orientation of the tumbling ship from the outside. Skelskard had not told her how to recover from a spin of this kind. The briefing had never envisaged that things would go this splendidly, abjectly wrong, but all she had to do was change things slightly, just enough to bring something else into view. Then, in a sudden fit of misery, she wondered what the point of that would be, given that she had already failed to make any sense of Floyd's initial impressions. She squeezed the trigger. Instead of the usual sequenced percussion of steering jets, all she heard was a low, dying hiss that faded as soon as it had begun. Earlier, with the emergency systems blaring and the impacts making an unholy din, she would never have heard that feeble whisper of last-ditch thrust. Would it be enough? She had felt nothing that would indicate a change of course. But the angle of the light source, the scything fan of light that touched the cabin interior with each rotation, had altered slightly. "All right," she said. "My turn to look now." Orga released her seat harness, and with great effort and equal discomfort, she managed to stand and brace herself so that she had a view through the window. The ship continued to tumble. The light source flared hard into view, making her squint and avert her eyes in reflex. It was an intense white disk with the faintest tinge of yellow. It looked, in fact, a lot like the sun. Then Floyd's smudge came into view. She had to hand it to him. His description was on the mark. It was a ruby-red nebula, like a blow-up from an astronomical photograph, flecked with spangles of light, smears of brighter red, and clotted with very dark patches, like dust lanes. Even as she watched, even before the rotation had pulled it out of view, a hard pink light flared within the cloud and died. "I don't know what it is," she said. "I've never seen anything like it before." Then the rotation brought something else into view. It was a gently curved arc of rust orange, fringed by a pale wisp of atmosphere. Unlike the smudge, this was something she had definitely seen before. She could even pick out the white scratches of the tethered dirigible lines and the ribbon-bright channels of the irrigation network. This was the other thing Floyd had seen. "It's Mars," she said, hardly believing her own words. "The big thing." "And the light?" "The sun," she said. "We've come out around Mars. We're in the solar system." "But you said..." She looked at the light-pocked smudge again. Just as Floyd had described, it appeared slightly smaller than the last time she had seen it, even though the smudge itself seemed to be roiling and expanding like the cloud from an explosion. And then the brightest light she had ever imagined, brighter even than the radiance of the wormhole throat, rammed through the smudge like sunlight piercing a stained glass window and reached a crescendo like a second sun. Then it faded, dying like the last chip of the setting sun, and when darkness had returned, the smudge was completely dark, undisturbed by any smaller flashes. "Where's Phobos?" Orga asked.